Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in today's program, we're going to discuss a recent investigation by the Center for Public Integrity about the struggle in this country over taxing the wealthy, which has recently become a state-level controversy. But first, last Saturday marked the one-year anniversary of historic protests in Iran, which continued for months and gave birth to a woman-led uprising. It all began with the death of a young Kurdish woman while in custody of Iran's so-called morality police, which then sparked a months-long nationwide protest led by women and girls who tossed off their headscarves in defiance and demanded the end to the Islamic Republic's rule. The regime's response was predictably violent and deadly. So a year later, what does Iran's social and political landscape look like? To find out, we're joined by two guests, Nilo Tabrizi, a video reporter for the Washington Post's visual forensics team. Before joining the Post, she worked as a video journalist at the New York Times, where she covered Iran, race and policing, and abortion access. Good to have you back, Nilo.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Khosrow Kalbasi Isfahani, who's a journalist, researcher, and an Oak Foundation Human Rights Fellow. Khosrow's work appeared in BBC Monitoring, the Atlantic Council, and Article 19, and he's written about Iran's violence against protesters and also helped the BBC to document and verify the identity of 75 Iranians who have been killed in the protests. Good to have you with us, Khosrow.
Hi, Ethan. Thanks for having me.
So, Khosrow, let me start with you. As I mentioned in the introduction, September 16th marked the anniversary of the uprising in Iran. How was this anniversary commemorated inside the country?
The Iranian regime, in all but name, imposed martial law, especially in Kurdish areas. They dispatched military-grade weaponry to the streets in Kurdish areas. They put families of those who have been killed during the recent uprising under house arrest, including family of Jina Amini. And they have been intimidating the families and civil society and anyone you can imagine to prevent any form of street protest. But this didn't stop people. People still took to streets in the impoverished Sistan Baluchistan province in southeast Iran, and they have continued resisting against the regime.
And you both have reported that in recent weeks and months, the Iranian authorities have ramped up their repression on civil society and family members of those who have been killed in the crackdown to prevent another wave of mass protests. Nilo, let me start with you on this. Can you tell us more about how the regime has targeted activists and civil society groups and who specifically has been targeted?
Yeah. So I reported out a story looking at the family members whose loved ones had been killed over the past year and looking at how they themselves became a target of the regime. And in a series of interviews, what I came to understand was that this was a systematic approach that the security forces and intelligence wings of the regime were kind of resorting to this in their playbook of protest suppression. So they would go after the family members. And there were three different cases that we looked at for a recent story for the Washington Post. And it was really heartbreaking to see that in one case, the case of Javad Haydari, who was killed in Qazvin, they went after the entire family, including briefly detaining, the 2-year-old niece of Javad. So, it's just kind of anyone who was connected to the protest, people who attended the funerals, everyone was targeted, unfortunately, over the past year.
Well, and Nilo, you have written about how, and interviewed grieving family members and who they've been able to discuss how Iranian authorities have systematically been surveilling them, detaining them, pressuring them to stay silent and off the streets. These are families whose sons and daughters were killed during the protest. Can you give us some examples of these intimidation tactics deployed by the regime there? And are any of these tactics new for the regime?
These tactics aren't new, but they're just the Iranian regime is just getting better at their state surveillance. This is just something that they have stepped up in over the last 10, 15 years, that they have just strengthened their ability to monitor people online, to surveil families, to deploy their intelligence wings. So if only they've just gotten better at this form of repression. So in one case that became quite public. The sister of Javad Haydari, in his funeral in September 2022, the funeral was broadcast live and she was cutting her hair over the funeral. This moment went viral because, you know, it had become very common recently, you know, in the past few years, that if you were killed by the state, your family, often to get the body of their loved one back, had to promise to not hold a public funeral, or in some cases even had to sign something saying, oh, this person died of a heart attack, to kind of absolve the state of any responsibility. So, you know, the Haydari family holding the funeral itself was a revolutionary act. You know, broadcasting it online was revolutionary, and then cutting her hair, which was very much in line with that moment. That moment, you know, no wonder it went viral, and, you know, it going viral brought the attention of the state onto the family. And so over the past year, this family, their home has been surveilled. It has been raided. Even when they had mourning ceremonies after his death, that those mourning ceremonies were surveilled by the state. There were incidences of tear gas and state repression at those mourning ceremonies. And the family has been forced into hiding because of all the pressure. And his sister, Fatima, she has lost her job. One of her sister-in-laws, you know, lost employment because of this. So, yeah, I mean, you can just see all the different levers of pressure that the regime has applied just on one family.
And Khosrow, I'm curious what you would add. I know you have recently written about a father whose 22-year-old son was executed back in January for taking part in the protest. Can you talk about some of your reporting on this and what you found?
Mohammad Mehdi Karami, who is better to call him by his Kurdish name that the Islamic Republic systematically tries to erase, Kumar, was executed over his role during the protest. His father, this kind, simple man who has been working as a worker, has been a very active voice for demanding justice for his son and other people who have been killed during this uprising. Mashallah Karami, this grieving father, over a month ago, he was arrested very violently, and the Islamic Republic, as if arresting a grieving father for demanding justice for the killing of his son, that wasn't enough. They have detained this grieving father at the same prison that his son was detained before his execution. The image of this father, his love, this pure love that he projects to the whole world to see, has shattered the soul of many people in Iran. His courage, his resilience, the way he has adopted any person who have been killed during this protest as his own children as well, the way he has been making food and distributing them among the poor to just commemorate the memory of his son, this level of love and honesty and kindness is something that has really moved the society. But that's exactly why the Islamic Republic is afraid of these people. These brave images of love and kindness, and that are in absolute defiance of the supreme leader's death cult that wants nothing but death and destruction for Iran. That's scary for an authoritarian regime that wants the society shattered into small islands of people that are constantly living in isolation.
We're talking about the one-year anniversary of the women-led protests in Iran. We're joined by Nilo Tabrizi, video reporter for the Washington Post visual forensics team, and Khosrow Kalbasi Isfahani, journalist, researcher, and an Oak Foundation human rights fellow. So, Nilo, I wanted to find out if the regime, are they going after loved ones who go public specifically, or are they basically just targeting all parents, all families whose sons and daughters have been killed in these protests.
Yeah, I mean, it's based on the interviews that I conducted, they're not going just after people who participated in the protest, but the families surrounding it. So like we mentioned, there were security forces and there were security and surveillance forces at one of Javad Haydari's mourning ceremonies, as well talking to Ramtin Fatahi, whose father Ramin was killed in the protests, who died after being tortured. They had gone after his uncle and aunt as well. And same with Hiwa Hosseinpuri's family. Hiwa is abroad receiving this news about his brother Azad being killed in the protest in Sanandaj, in Mahabad. And they went after members of the Hosseinpuri family who weren't protesting. So it's all about looking at who's at the center. So who's the person in the family who protested, and how can we get to the rings that kind of expand around them and intimidate those people into not seeking justice or them further being activated to go out in the streets. I think it's, the Islamic Republic understands the power of grief and how grief can turn into rage and can turn into action in social movements. They use that idea of grief and the power of grief themselves during the revolutionary period. So kind of understanding the context of that perhaps illuminates why they go after these families and the families of martyrs in such a way.
And Khosrow, are there other civil society groups that have been targeted? I mean, are there any leaders beyond the grieving family members that the regime has been going after out of fear that they're going to galvanize some of this grief, as Nilo just described?
In the weeks leading up to Jina Amini's death anniversary, we witnessed that the Islamic Republic was literally going after anyone who has a voice in any social spaces, whether it was journalists, student activists, labor activists, whatever you can think of, dozens of people, hundreds of them from each of these communities were targeted. As always, the civil society took the brunt of it, but at the same time, the ethnic minorities were a priority target for the regime in the lead up to the anniversary. So the whole campaign, its aim was sowing seeds of fear in the society to prevent people from showing any sort of resistance or opposition to the regime on the anniversary.
And Nila, what's the state now of protests? Are protests still ongoing, or have they been completely squelched by these repressive actions by the Iranian regime?
Yeah, I think Khosrow, said it quite well at the top, that there were some protests that were happening despite the, effective but not actual martial law that the regime imposed. There was just such intimidation in the weeks, months leading up to the anniversary that, absolutely the people felt the pressure and understood the stakes of protesting. But I think what's really key to note is that just because there aren't people on the streets right now doesn't mean that the support for the movement has gone away. For years, Iranians have become growingly dissatisfied with the Islamic Republic. And just because we're not seeing them on the streets, again, like that sentiment is still there, but it's more reflective of just how good the state is at repressing these movements. I just wanted to note that and highlight that and give an understanding. And I think that these protest movements and these more so these street protests flourish when the security state is caught off guard. So perhaps they didn't expect Mahsa Jina Amini's death to spark the movement that it did. So being caught off guard allowed these street protests to flourish. But they were well aware of the anniversary, right? So they clamped down, step by step in the months and weeks leading up to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a question for you both, how, as journalists, how difficult has it been for you and for other journalists outside of Iran to connect with these activists in the country, given that so many of them now are in prison and those who are not yet detained, are rightfully very afraid of being arrested in the crackdown? And Khosrow, let me start with you with that question.
One of the things that you should take into account is that a staple of Islamic Republic's response to any form of civil disobedience, any form of protest, has been imposing internet disruptions or even total internet shutdowns. Nilu mentioned the example of Javed Haydari's family being constantly under pressure. Their home was raided literally yesterday. The village where they live, all roads were blocked to that village. Internet was totally shut down there, so the voice of this family could not reach the world. But the thing is that people in Iran have constantly showed resilience and level of resourcefulness when it comes to finding ways for making their voice being heard by the world. And as a journalist, both me and Nilo have been doing this job for too long. We have established contacts and networks that enable us to get the information out of Iran and amplify it. That's our main job, to reflect the voices of people who are being denied any access to public platforms.
We certainly appreciate your efforts to bring a wider audience the story. Nilo, do you want to respond about your perspective on the challenge for journalists outside of the country to bring the story to the wider world?
Yeah. So I work on a team at the Washington Post called Visual Forensics, and the type of investigative story that we do, storytelling that we do, centers on open source reporting. So what that means is taking pieces of evidence of the protests in Iran and verifying it and being able to kind of reveal something new based on that evidence. And so that type of reporting, I think, is invaluable to documenting the movement in Iran and other international stories and domestic stories as well. But it takes time. You know, sometimes it can take me a day or two to verify just one video. So this type of documentation, which kind of also shares its roots with human rights documentation that's done at Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other organizations, you know, this work cements this moment in time, and we're able to verify it. Like, we don't just tweet out videos or share videos that are being reposted. So kind of taking the care to verify that takes a long time, but I think is also what enables us to reveal information or to be able to give a degree of certainty and to verify these accounts that we're seeing from inside the country.
And I want to open the phone lines now. We're talking about the one-year anniversary of the protests in Iran. We're joined by Nilo Tabrizi, a video reporter for the Washington Post Visual Forensics team, and Khosrow Kalbasi Isfahani, journalist, researcher, and Oak Foundation Human Rights Fellow. We'd love to hear from you if you have relatives in Iran, if you have questions for our guests about what the latest is in that country on the ground, what the prospects for change might be. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Nilo, I wanted to ask also about how dangerous it is for journalists in the country to write about this. The two journalists who were responsible for breaking the story of Mahsa Amini, yeah, the Kurdish Iranian woman who was killed and really sparked these protests, they faced trial in Iran and have now been in prison for the past 8 months on charges of conspiracy and rebellion against national security. What is your take on the state of journalism just within the country now?
It's incredibly dismal. The personal safety risks of being a journalist in Iran are quite high. I have many friends who are reporters in the country for major papers or different online organizations, and they routinely get interrogated by the intelligence wings. So it's incredibly it's an incredibly dangerous job to do journalism from inside the country. And at the same time, I mean, this is who we owe everything to. We, like us in the West, we would never have known about what happened to Mahsa Jina Amini if Niloufar and Elahe did not risk their freedom and safety to tell us what happened. And for me, like, anytime I report on Iran or I'm looking into something, I always get gut check my ideas or things with my sources, who include reporters inside the country. It's an incredibly difficult job, and we owe everything to them.
And Khosrow, has the regime been targeting Iranian journalists who are operating outside of the country? Have there been efforts by the regime to try to silence the global story here?
I just want to add one point to what Nilo rightly said. When you watch what Iranian journalists who are working on the ground are putting it on the line, it's just humbling. We are sitting in safe environments and trying to make top from bottom of these stories. But there are journalists on the ground in Iran who are risking their lives. One of them, Nazila Maroufian, was arrested 4 times over the past 3 months. Last time when she was arrested, she was sexually assaulted, tortured just for voicing support for an artist who has been defying the regime's narrative about the protests. This is the level of sacrifice that journalists inside Iran are making. And yes, there is pressure on journalists who are based outside the country as well. Many of my former colleagues at the BBC and other institutions have faced threats to their families. Their families have been arrested and held in custody for days at some points. But the thing is, when you watch at the context of Iran, when you see how brave people are in face of this oppressive state, that courage, what we are doing pales before that. We are not even doing enough, in my opinion.
And let's talk about how these protests have changed Iranian society. Nilo, I'm going to start with you on this. How have people responded? What's the cultural change? I've heard anecdotally from people who have visited Iran that it's been pretty remarkable seeing how many women now are walking around without head covering on. Can you talk a little bit about how this has changed the culture there?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak about it from just the perspective of being a reporter and reporting on Iran from afar. So in previous protest rounds, it's always difficult to get any type of visual evidence of protests from online from Iran. So because the government, you know, one of their tactics is to cut off the internet and make it really difficult to communicate with the outside world. They were still doing that in this protest round, but in any story that I reported, I was able to get connected to eyewitnesses or people who filmed certain pieces of evidence much easier. I really got the sense, based on the folks that I spoke with, that this increasing sentiment of we have nothing to lose. And so seeing just kind of this like escalating level of bravery of people willing to put their bodies and their safety on the line to communicate what was going on with the outside world, that to me felt like a shift as an observer who's been reporting on Iran since 2017.
And Khosrow, anything you want to add to that, to what changes have been happening now on the ground in response to the protests?
One of the greatest changes that I have witnessed over the past year is that, like every totalitarian state, the Islamic Republic has tried to shatter the society into isolated islands of people. But during this recent uprising from Jina's blood and the fire of this uprising, a new united front has been born inside the country. You witness that the needs and the oppression of marginalized groups has become a mainstream debate inside and outside the country. You see that when the LGBTQ community demands visibility, it is teachers' union that comes and support them in their call. When there is oppression in Kurdistan, you see Balochistan taking to streets and holding placards that read, Balochistan is not going to let Kurdistan stand alone. And this type of unity is something new in Iran. And it prophesies a better future for that country.
And Khosrow, I mentioned in your introduction that you were part of a team that used forensic techniques to verify the identities of more than 75 of those who have been killed by the regime based on these protests. How did you go about verifying that number and the identities of those who were killed?
That process was literally the hardest task that I have ever faced as a journalist. We were going through photos and videos of people who were shot dead during these protests and trying to just identify that if they are actually the person from identification cards, from photos on their graves, from statements, the families. And we were trying to corroborate each and every death, at least in three ways, to be sure. We started from scratch. It included interviews with families going through, as Nilu mentioned, open source information available on the internet, and then contacting sources on the ground that were so generous with sharing their information and contacts. But one of the issues that we faced during that period, that project, was that when it came to deaths among the ethnic minorities, there were people who the first images that emerged of them on internet was images of their dead bodies. They didn't have access to smartphones to take photos of themselves and post them on social media. And imagine how far you need to go to find someone in their family that can send you a photo of their ID card that you can compare it with the photo of their dead body to see if that's actually the person you're talking about.
Well, we only have a few minutes left here, and I'd like to find out from the two of you what people are saying is likely to happen next year based on your contacts with activists on the ground. What's the future of this movement? And Nilo, let me start with you with that question.
I do not have my tarot card, so I'm not good at predicting anything, but what I will say, just kind of based on looking at the way that grieving families have been targeted, is that, like, and talking to different professors who study social movements, they always call out grief as being one of the most powerful emotions that kind of keeps the spark of a social movement alive. It turning grief turning into rage into action, like that cycle is a framework that was called out many times to me. And so when I see the way that these families have been targeted, it makes me think that perhaps there is an unintended consequence that the Islamic Republic isn't thinking about, how this grief can unite these families. We already saw in this movement that families who lost loved ones after they were killed by the state in protests in previous rounds, those families joined up with the current grieving families and kind of united together. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what seeds that will sow for the future.
And Khosrow, same question for you, the last question of this segment. What are your contacts on the ground saying is likely to come out of this?
There is no going back for Iran. This is the sentence that literally every person that I've been talking to been repeating again and again and again. From day one, prominent rights defenders like Nasrin Sotoudeh have been saying that Iran after Jinnah's killing is a different place. And the Islamic Republic, despite all its efforts, cannot push Iran back to days before Jinnah was killed. This sentence that there is no going back for Iran, a couple of days ago, Atena Daimi, a human rights defender inside Iran who has been in jail for 7 years during the past 10 years, 7 out of 10, she wrote an op-ed for the Post, and that's literally where she ends her opinion piece. There is no going back for Iran.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but I just want to thank you both so much for joining us and explaining what's happening in Iran to the wider world. That's Nilo Tabrizi, video reporter for the Washington Post visual forensics team, and Khosrow Kalbazi-Isfahani, journalist, researcher, and Oak Foundation human rights fellow. Thank you both so much for joining us on Your Call.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And coming up next, we'll be talking about state-level efforts to address controversies around taxing the wealthy. So stay with us here on Your Calls Media Roundtable.